Good to see everybody. Thank you for coming today. We're going to continue with our study of Proverbs. The chapters that we're going to take a look at today are in chapter 6 and 7. We've been talking about this concept of spiritual wisdom and what it really means, kind of get an idea for what God means by wisdom as opposed to what the world means by wisdom, get an idea for how we can obtain this kind of spiritual wisdom that God talks about. Last week we looked at the idea of wisdom and discipline, the kind of discipline that's required to get spiritual wisdom. It's a different kind of discipline than worldly discipline. And this week's topic is wisdom and perspective, the idea that God's wisdom is not just to acquire a collection of knowledge for knowledge's sake, the idea that God's wisdom is really intended to give us a perspective on life, a different way of looking at things. And so that's kind of what the topic today is. We'll take a look in Proverbs chapter 6. It gives us some examples from daily life that have some helpful spiritual parallels. And then there's a passage in here about wisdom and faithfulness, how those two things go together. And then at the end of chapter 7, there's a parable about the youth who lacks judgment. It parables a youth needlessly getting himself into trouble, and it's interesting in its own right and perhaps some practical lessons in its own right, but the real significance of it is kind of a spiritual parable of how we as believers sometimes let ourselves get drawn away from the truths of the gospel and into worldly kind of thinking. So that's kind of where we're going today. Larry's going to lead us in a short time of prayer to get ready to study, and then we'll do some Proverbs.
Dear God, our Holy Father, we come before you humbly at this time on this Sunday morning. Father, humble because we realize that we do not deserve all that you have done for us. All of the blessings of our lives, everything that we have to use and to enjoy, our families, the people that we love, and most of all, your Son that you sent to this earth. We don't deserve it. We're grateful for those who love us in spite of our. Father, please be with us this morning in this time of study, later in our worship. Keep us close to you, and through your Son that we pray.
Amen. Amen. Thank you very much. Just to kind of bring you up to date here, if you want to look over to Proverbs 6, where we're going to start to read in a minute, the chapters at the beginning of Proverbs, the first nine chapters are this kind of general discussion of spiritual wisdom. There aren't too many actual, what you would call, proverbs per se, but it's talking about the idea of spiritual wisdom, how it differs from the world's wisdom, and some of the general qualities that God is interested in. Proverbs 10 to 24, which we'll be getting to in the next couple of weeks, this is really the collection of the Proverbs of Solomon from chapter 10 through most of that section. And then at the very end, there are a few sayings of the wise that are collected along with Solomon's parallels. That was the original book of Proverbs back in the days of Solomon himself. A couple hundred years later, in the days of King Hezekiah, they collected some more sayings of Solomon. A lot of them were things Solomon had written or said that weren't included in the original book, and then some sayings from some other sources, and so these are kind of some added Proverbs. So that section of the book is a little bit different. What we've talked about so far is the key words that you see a lot in the beginning of the book, what the first five chapters, are wisdom and discipline. The key thing to notice is that spiritual wisdom is not the same as worldly wisdom. Spiritual wisdom is not just learning a lot of facts or methods or even theology. Spiritual wisdom is something different. It's something that's harder even to define. And last week, when we looked at the concept of spiritual discipline is not just fleshly regimentation. You know, you think of discipline and you think, make a bunch of rules, do it this way. Or you think of, I always think of one of my teachers from school who used to quiz us on our Greek lessons and wander around the room with a yardstick just to give us a little encouragement to get the right answers. And likewise, spiritual discipline is not the same as worldly discipline. It means disciplining your mind to see things from God's point of view. And today we'll look at spiritual perspective. This is another difference between worldly wisdom and godly wisdom, that worldly wisdom seeks wisdom for what essentially are practical purposes or even selfish purposes, Knowledge for knowledge's sake, knowledge so people think you're smart, knowledge so that you can take it out and use it to get things you wanted out of the world. God's wisdom is very different. There's times when it comes in what we would call very practical, but most of the time, what God's wisdom is designed to do is give us perspective, help us see things differently. As Paul said in Ephesians, to open the eyes of your heart. And if you insist on reading that verse literally, you'll probably want to go sign Paul up for a course in remedial anatomy, because there's no such thing as the eyes of the heart. It's an expression to tell you what I'm trying to do, or what God's trying to do, what the Holy Spirit is trying to do, is not just fill you with facts. Help you to take a new look at things. Look at this world differently. Look at yourself differently. Look at God differently from all the stereotypes and conventional things that the world tries to teach you. So let's get into chapter 6. We're going to read some things here about daily living and the way that they have spiritual parallels. One of the things about Proverbs is that it shows that even the more mundane aspects or the more routine aspects of your daily life can have spiritual parallels. It can show you things about God. It can show you things about human nature. And it also goes the other way, that spiritual principles can often have uses or illustrations in daily life. So it kind of goes both ways around there. Chapter 6, let's see. Bev, could you read the first 5 verses for us? And Phil, since you have your nice clean Bible instead of that unclean technological device, could you read verses 6 to 11? And then Lloyd, if you could finish up verses 12 to 19. We're not going to finish the whole chapter there.
To the end, you sluggard, consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores provisions in the summer and gathers its food at harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit and scarcity like an armed man.
A scoundrel and villain who goes about with a corrupt mouth, who winks with his eye, signals with his feet, and motions with his fingers, who plots evil with deceit in his heart, he always stirs up dissension. Therefore, disaster will overtake him in an instant. He will suddenly be destroyed without remedy. There are 6 things the Lord hates, 7 that are detestable to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked schemes, feet that are quick to rush into evil, a false witness who pours out lies, and a man who stirs up dissension among brothers.
Thank you very much. And I should say there's not a lot of significance in whom I gave those readings to, but there might be a little bit there. I did give Phil the one about the ant, because Phil it doesn't have a real good record on animal rights, but we've recruited him now for our campaign for animal safe metaphors, and he's recovering. So I thought I could trust him to read the passage about the ant today. There are 3 basic things that he talks about here, with a practical dimension, but also that there are important spiritual lessons. The first one is this illustration where it says, if you put up security or a pledge, if you've been trapped by what you said, and now you realize it was a bad idea. And it's talking about very specifically one situation, but the illustration is really meant to be more general than that. Specifically, it's talking about a man who has pledged to his neighbor, it's basically someone who's co-signed for a bad loan. He's got a neighbor who's not a good risk, and so he's put up his own property for his neighbor, just kind of impulsively, you know, well-intentioned more than likely, but not very well advisedly. And now he goes home and he thinks, I shouldn't have done that. That was not a good idea. And so the passage is, well, what do you do? What do you do? And so it's really talking about getting a release from an entanglement, because our tongues get us in a lot of trouble. Our emotions get us in a lot of trouble. Our insecurities get us in a lot of trouble. You know, we can get talked into doing something that we realize we just don't have time for. even in church sometimes. Sometimes we have domineering church leaders who can pressure you into doing something and you realize, I really don't feel that comfortable doing that. I really don't have the time to do that. Maybe you met one of my uncles and he talked you into signing something you shouldn't have signed. It happens. These things all occur in life. You get into trouble. And the thing that human nature does, if you think about it for a minute, what does human nature usually do when you talk yourself into a situation or someone talks you into a situation and now you know it's a bad idea? Well, what we usually do is one of two things. We either try to pretend that, I'm going to control all the time here. Yeah, I knew that all along. Yeah, absolutely. Then you try just to counter-talk your way out of it. Or you come up with one of these schemes. You know, like Lucy Ricardo used to do on television, come up with some bizarre scheme to try to get yourself out of something and still save face. Well, he gives you a very simple remedy in verse 3. There's a key phrase at the end of verse 3. What does he say to do when you got yourself in a pinch that you really shouldn't have gotten into? Does he say to scheme and plot? Does he say to counterattack and sue the person and get out of it? Or does he say to do something else?
Yeah,
four words. Go and humble yourself. In other words, you got yourself in over your head. This is the remedy. That's a spiritual remedy, and it's a lesson for practical life and for spiritual life as well. Just go and humble yourself. Admit that you're in over your head. Admit that we need God. Admit that we have a lot of things that we don't deserve, and so there's no reason to try to sue somebody or argue with somebody if we get stuck. So, when he says, go and humble yourself, that's a guarantee that things will work out great then, right? You go and humble yourself, it's a promise. God will make sure that you get things work out exactly the way that you want, right?
No.
Okay, I've asked questions like that often enough, you know the answer to that's no. That's not the way it works. What it's saying is not that if you humble yourself, you'll get the result you want. What it's saying is, if you learn to humble yourself, God can always use the situation in some positive way. It may or may not be to extricate you from the goofy situation you got in. It may not be to take the foot out of your mouth, but it will be something positive instead of just something negative. If you're just stuck in a situation and you scheme and plot and try to deceive your way out of it, that doesn't work. If you just try to sit there and sullenly go along with it, it's just going to lead to a lot of negative things. Those of you who follow the Cincinnati Reds, you may listen to the games on the radio sometimes, and they have this radio announcer, Marty Brenneman, who's actually a very famous announcer. He's very highly respected in most ways. He's actually in the Baseball Hall of Fame. He's been around for a long time. He has what I think is a very negative characteristic. He can be very overly critical of the team. He's a perfectionist. And he's all the time, when the team doesn't win, he can be very critical. And sometimes he says things that get him in trouble. And last year, early in the season, the Reds were not playing well, and he was being very critical of the team. And before a game one time, he was sitting talking with some of the coaches on the team, and he was saying, how come this guy's not hitting better? And how come that guy's making these errors? And how come the pitchers aren't doing better? And the coaches were just explaining, look, it's early in the season. You know, we're working with these guys. We know they make mistakes. You know, we think we've got a lot of talent here. It's going to come together. We just want the fans to be patient. He said, yeah, but what about this and what about that and that error the guy made and the bad play the guy made? And this one coach said, you see, the thing is, Marty, when you got a real talented team like this, you just be patient with it, because if the team ever comes together, we're the kind of team that could win 10 games in a row. And Marty said, if this team ever wins 10 games in a row, I'll shave my head. And you have to know, Marty Brenneman loves his hair. He's got these real flamboyant hairstyles from the 70s that he still proudly wears. So shaving his head would be an immense sacrifice. He wasn't thinking. He was just being critical. He was just wanting to get his point across. This team's crummy. You guys need to do something. And instead, he just said something silly, because a month or so later, the team started playing really well, and they won 8 games in a row. And one of the players had overheard that. And he's not real popular with some of the players because of how critical he can be. And so one of the players happened to mention to a reporter, early in the season, I heard Marty talking to the coaches, and he said if we won 10 games in a row, he'd shave his head. We're going to hold him to that. So they went out, and they won the 9th game in a row. And so then they're playing the 10th game, and they're ahead late in the game, and all the players are peeking out of the dugout, pointing up at the radio booth like, yeah, we're coming for you here. And there's one player that's making the little snipping motions with his hands. Sure enough, they won 10 games in a row. And so the reporter said to Marty, well, you're going to make good on this. And he said, well, I've got to think about this. So He thought about it. He realized what he had done. It was a foolish thing to say. He got himself in trouble. And so the next night when he was announcing the game, he said, "You know, some of you know that I made a rash comment early in the season that if the team won 10 games in a row, I'd shave my head. I'm going to do that. I said it. I shouldn't have said it. I was being too critical. I deserve it." And so after the game Friday night, I'm going to go down to the clubhouse. I'm going to let the players cut my hair off because they want it. Well, the thing about that was, because he humbled himself, something else happened. It's not just that, okay, he's a man of his word, he learned a little lesson. It was actually even better than that, because there's a hospital in Cincinnati where they have a cancer ward for young children. And they're going through chemotherapy, and it's very hard on young children. And they have to shave their heads, and so they don't look like normal children, and it's a very, very delicate thing for people to handle. And these little kids were listening to the game, and they didn't even understand about his foolish comment or anything. All they heard is, after the game Friday night, I'm going to shave my head. And one of the kids says, "Hey, after the game, Marty's going to look just like us. Isn't that cool?" And one of the nurses happened to hear that, and she knew somebody who worked for the Reds, and said, "You know, it's kind of cool. The kids really kind of connected with that. It kind of perked up the kids a little bit." And so what they did, instead of having his head shaved in the clubhouse, is after the game that Friday, they brought him out on the field, and they made a big thing out of it. And they brought in these kids from the cancer hospital, and they used it to raise money for the kids in the cancer hospital, and to draw attention to the fact that these little kids have a lot of needs. Be sensitive to kids with illnesses and their families, because it's really difficult for them. And the cutest thing was, the kids in this cancer hospital, they give them these little t-shirts, because when they come in and they start their chemotherapy and they lose their hair, they give them a little t-shirt that says, "I'm still me," just to kind of instill in them a sense that they're still a valuable person. And so after Marty gave got his head shaved, one of the little cancer kids came out and gave Marty an adult t-shirt that says, "I'm still me." And so it was a very nice thing. It was a very nice thing, because he humbled himself, turned an idiotic comment into something very nice. Now, here's the thing, as Adrian Monk likes to say. By humbling himself, did Marty get the result he wanted and keep his precious hair? No. But God was able to use it for something positive. And that's the thing about humbling yourself. Humbling yourself is not a tactic to get what you want. Humbling yourself is a spiritual principle to let God act in a positive way, even when you've done or said something very foolish. So there's the spiritual parallel from even a very seemingly a mundane situation. Next illustration, we have, I always like these animal illustrations, we have an ant. Now, ants are known for many things, and those of you who are arthropod phobic, you may want to tune out for a few minutes, think about the trivia question or something like that. Ants are known for a lot of things, but what is it highlighting in this passage about the ant? It highlights really two different qualities. They're workers, they're diligent, and it highlights one other thing that's maybe not quite as obvious here in verse 7. They don't have anybody in charge of them. They don't boss people. They don't boss each other around. They just, by their nature, do their work. They don't wait for someone to tell them what to do. They just take the initiative. Now, for those of you who like to keep track of things, the kind of ant that he's talking about here is a common species of harvester ant that was common in that area. We have a lot of harvester ants in the Americas too. That's probably more entomological detail than you want to know. The ants, though, they have a very well-defined social structure, but it's not a leadership structure. Every ant knows its role. They don't boss each other around or police them. You have ants loafing around and not doing something, they don't give them a ticket or anything like that. Ants just accept the fact, I have certain things to do, and when they see something, they jump on it. When they see food, they know it's my duty not just to sit and eat this, it's my duty to bring it back to everybody else. And so he's using the ant as an example of being a worker, but also taking the initiative yourself, seeing the needs out there, not waiting for someone to tell you what to do, not waiting for someone to say, you know, we could be doing this. Because as Christians, we can become certainly literal sluggards, sitting around and not doing anything. And later in the book of Proverbs, there are some very funny proverbs about literal sluggards. But what this parable is really about is spiritual sluggards. We just let people tell us what to believe, tell us what to do. Here's what the church believes. Okay, fine, that's good enough for me. Here's what we're going to do. Okay, I'll do it. Yeah, whatever. Instead of looking around at all those needs out there. Because if you wait for a preacher or a Bible class teacher or an elder to tell you a need, you're really not getting it, because there's so many needs out there. There's so many people that need encouragement, so many people that have physical needs in their life. And instead of just waiting for someone to organize something for us, just getting in the habit of doing these things for people like an ant would do, that's really the example that he's giving us. And now a word from our sponsor. Because I was told, speaking in connection with this, I was told in connection with the fact that one of our members had a birthday last week who is known for looking at meeting needs. I have had this looks like a matchbook, it's not. It's a little mint inside here. It's Random Acts of Kindness for Norma. And this is our sponsor of their class this week, so if you would kindly patronize the sponsor's product, they're over there on the table over there. Our sponsor, who is getting up to demonstrate at this very moment here, is demonstrating this for you because Norma is known for random acts of kindness. She was also known for random acts of a lot of other things that we don't need to go into, but random acts of kindness is the thing that he's really talking about here, is this just look for needs and meet them instead of waiting for people to tell you. The last portion of this that we read about is talking about a troublemaker. And it's not just a generic troublemaker, someone who gets into things themselves. It's talking about someone who deliberately provokes trouble for other people, someone who enjoys dissension, someone who enjoys discontent, someone who likes to tell people things that he knows will get them upset and disturbed. There are lots of people like this. There are lots of people in society who benefit from provoking dissension, from criticism, from getting you angry, from getting you upset about a problem you didn't even know existed. Everything from advertisers who want to make you think that your life is going to be ruined if you don't buy their product, to politicians who want to manipulate you often by using God's name in a self-centered way, to people that you work for who might want to exploit your time and energy for their own purposes and make you afraid of losing your job, make you afraid of not fitting in. Now, most of you are not what are troublemakers in this sense, but the problem is a little bit different. Now, I should clarify, some of you are troublemakers in a little bit more benign sense, you know, such as our dear sister Gloria and her sister Linda back there. Yeah, they love to make trouble for me. You know, they're always teasing me and making my life a little bit more surreal. But I actually enjoy it. I actually enjoy getting attention from two such charming sisters as Gloria and her sister. So that's not the kind of troublemaker he's talking about. He's talking about the kind of person that will deliberately stir up a dissension, deliberately make you dissatisfied with your church, with your country, with your leaders, whatever it is. Your problem, most of you, is not being a troublemaker, it's being vulnerable to troublemakers. It's actually respecting troublemakers, because there's been people here in our own congregation who were troublemakers, that some of you characters respected them for coming in and saying, oh yeah, we're not doing enough. We need to be doing this. You need to be doing that. Why weren't you there last night? You're not measuring up to the standard. God wants more out of you. That's respected by a lot of people in the church. The world does that, the church does that, and too many people are intimidated by it instead of laughing at it as you should, because it's goofy. It's a goofy way of putting God's principles into practice, because it's antithetical to the values of the gospel. The values of the gospel are the values of the ant. Yes, be diligent. Look around for something you can do. But don't boss each other around. There's so many needs out there. Just help each other to become sensitive and gracious, and then we don't need to boss people around and make them feel guilty if they don't do something that we think they should be doing. And so that's really the godly perspective. And he has this passage that we read, the six things the Lord hates, the seven that are detestable to him. Your haughty eyes and a lying tongue and a heart that schemes, a false witness and a man who stirs up dissension. It's just to remind us that those things are not acceptable even if they produce results. Results are never the standard. It's the principles that are the standard from a godly perspective. Now this next section, as we look into chapter 6, picking back up in the text in verse 20, it returns to the use of adultery as kind of a parable or as kind of a metaphor. Adultery, of course, is a sin or an offense, but here it's really used as a parallel for spiritual unfaithfulness or for spiritual adultery. Frequently through the Old Testament, especially in the prophets, physical adultery is used as an illustration of more serious spiritual offenses, because physical adultery, the reason why it's bad, it's not because it breaks a rule. The reason why God tells you not to do it is because it hurts people. It destroys relationships, it destroys families, destroys friendships. It hurts people in a lot of ways that aren't maybe physical or violent, but it's very destructive to relationships. And relationships is what matters to God the most, because relationships is what's going to last when we leave this world and move into eternity. And so what he talks here about warning against people against adultery, it's really talking about something more than just the physical adultery, because most Christians can look at warnings about adultery and say, oh yeah, yeah, those snakes out there, that slime out there, yes, I'm glad I'm not like one of them. And you need to read that little parable about the Pharisee and the tax collector. Because as this illustrates here, you know, humbling ourselves is key to God. You know, Matthew 23, he who humbles himself will be exalted, and he exalts himself will be humbled. So looking at this, instead of judging others who don't obey this, it's really a call. You know, let's think about our spiritual loyalty to make sure we're truly faithful to God and his values, not to the things the world has put in us. And he talks about, keep your father's commands, do not forsake your mother's teaching, bind them on your heart forever, fasten them around you your neck. When you walk, they will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. When you awake, they will speak to you. And so it's talking about the wisdom that God has. It stays with you. God's wisdom is personal. God's wisdom is not for the sake of getting results. It's not for the sake of accomplishing tasks or results or anything like that. God's wisdom is personal. It's to be with you. It's to be on your heart. It's to be with you. And he says, this is what keeps you, verse 24, this is what keeps you from the immoral woman, the smooth tongue of the wayward wife. Do not lust in your heart after her beauty, or let her captivate you with her eyes, because the prostitute reduces you to a loaf of bread. And that's kind of a graphic expression to say that you, when you forsake your wedding vows or your true relationships for a moment of sensual thrills, you're reducing yourself and the person you're doing that with to a loaf of bread, just a physical lump instead of a soul, instead of a person. But again, it's talking about more than just the literal instance of adultery. It's talking about that getting God's wisdom in your heart is not a matter of trying to please the world. God's wisdom is going to make you look kind of strange to the world. The world can be very unforgiving. And he goes on to talk about, in this next passage, after he talks about you, the wisdom of God being like a lamp and a light. Verse 30, men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his hunger when he is starving, yet if he's caught, he's going to pay. A man who commits adultery lacks judgment. He destroys himself. Blows and disgrace are his lot, for jealousy arouses a husband's fury, and he'll show no mercy when he takes revenge. You know, it's kind of the old saying, truth or consequences is what he's talking about here. God says, live by the truth or you face the consequences. But where we go wrong is because we think that what God's done is that he's angry with us when we disobey him, and so he swats us around a little bit. And that's not what he's talking about. He's saying, look, I'm telling you how to live because I know human nature. I made them. I wrote the instruction manual on them. That world is very unforgiving. They're waiting for you to make a mistake. It's not a nice, friendly place out there. And when you live in certain ways, you're going to arouse their self-righteousness. You're going to arouse their hostility because they're looking for a way to exploit each other. The world is full of dissatisfied, unhappy people who will take out their anger and frustration on one another. Even the devil himself, in one of Frank Chappell's favorite passages in Revelation 12. Why is he so nasty to us? Because he knows his time is short. He didn't get his way. He didn't get to take charge. He's stuck down here, and he knows his time's short, and he's going to hurt as many people as he can to take as many people as he can with them. And it's a different perspective on this concept of discipline and consequences to our sins, because the world can be a very unforgiving place. And we too often try to manipulate the world to our own advantage instead of realizing, no, the world is not set up to reward us or to give us things. There's an old story. If you remember Russell Baker, the longtime columnist, he wrote a book of some of his memoirs of working in Washington, D.C., and he has a few stories about President Lyndon Johnson, who was known for being very domineering and very aggressive in his ways of getting people to do the things he wanted them to do and kind of keep them a little bit insecure. Lyndon Johnson was from Texas. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but that's it's an interesting fact that you might throw in there. And Russell Baker remembers that one time he saw Lyndon Johnson come into one of the cabinet departments, and there was a young man that had just been hired, and they said, oh, the president's coming. Everybody look busy. And so this young man took out some folders on his desk and had this stuff here so that he looked real busy. And the president came up to his desk, said, young man, I hope your mind isn't as messy as your desk is. And he walked away. So the young man was humiliated. Well, a couple months later, the president's coming. Everybody looked busy. And this young man remembered, okay, no messy desk. He put everything away, got it all neat and tidy, everything all neat. And he's at attention, and the president comes up. Young man, I hope your mind isn't as empty as your desk is. You can't make the world happy, and we just should stop trying. It's not a question of provoking confrontation with the world. It's just learning not to try to manipulate the world like they're trying to manipulate us. The world is not set up for Christian values. And it's just a delusion when we think that somehow if we just live the way God wants us to, we're going to get all these rewards, because that's not what God's after. God's after us being an example of a different kind. The early Christians changed a lot of things around them, not by confronting or anger or hostility or writing nasty letters to the emperor, but by letting themselves be persecuted, by showing that you can suffer and still be gracious and loving, by carrying out Jesus' own example when he was dying a horrible death and said, Father, forgive them, because they don't know what they're doing. The world does not run by God's principles, never has, never will. Our country does not run on God's principles, never has, never will. Every society just has its own version of it, and they have a lot of propaganda that a lot of people have spent a lot of time coming up with to try to keep your minds off of it. But as the great Pierre-Joseph Proudhon used to say, all laws are cobwebs for the rich and chains for the poor. It's all to serve the people at the top. And that's what it's about. And if you understand that, then you don't get so angry about things. Because what God is after is not for us to try to yell and scream and act like the world, to try to fix things because they're inconvenient for us, but to learn to show the world that God knows, God cares, and there are people who are willing to live by that even when we get shoved around for it. This last passage that we want to look at the end of chapter 7, this is this parable about a youth who lacks judgment. And it's a parable about adultery, but it's by no means just meant to be a teaching about adultery itself. It's meant to talk about the way that we get in trouble. You know, we looked at this first situation, what to do when you get yourself entangled. This is kind of a look at the way we get in trouble. And it uses this silly young man, chapter 7, verse 6, at the window of my house, I looked through the lattice, I saw among the simple, I noticed among the young men a youth who lacked judgment. Now, when Proverbs says simple, just to remind you, it's a simple person in Proverbs, do you remember what it is? It's someone who doesn't know any better. As opposed to a fool in Proverbs is what? Someone who knows better and does it. So when you, and most versions are very consistent. So when it talks about someone simple, this guy, it's not a bad guy in what he's saying. This is not someone who is deliberately looking to do something wrong. He is basically just a waiting victim. He's someone who's simple. He's someone who's never taken the time to learn right from wrong. He doesn't know what he's doing. And so he's wandering close to trouble. It says, he was going down the street near her corner, walking along in the direction of her house at twilight as the day was fading, as the dark of night set in. Then out came a woman to meet him, dressed like a prostitute and with crafty intent. She is loud and defiant. Her feet never stay at home. Now in the street, now in the squares, at every corner she looks. So he's wandering along, and the literal situation is just that he's wandering too close to trouble. It's not something evil, it's just something ill-advised. And here again, we could have a great time. Oh yeah, those people out there, they just play with their sensual desires and that, and we can feel great about ourselves. But think instead about the way that we, without knowing it, wander close to spiritual trouble. When you carry around a grudge, when you carry around a resentment, when you carry around a feeling that somebody owes you something, when you carry around a feeling that you deserve more out of life than you should, what are you doing? You're walking close to a spiritual prostitute who's just ready to tell you, oh, you don't have a good life, do you? That guy's to blame for it. You're not happy with the way things are in society? That guy's to blame for it. That's exactly the same thing as this goof wandering around near the adulteress's house, just waiting to be drawn into her sin. When we carry around these resentments and anger and hostility, prejudices, anything that's inside there that's not right, it's just waiting for it to be exploited by the world. This is why Jesus, for example, said in Matthew 5, you've heard that it was said, do not murder. But I tell you that everyone who hates his brother is just as subject to judgment. because it can be just as easily turned into something horrible. And so as Christians, the lesson from this passage is not just to restrict it to the sensual sin that he's talking about here, but to realize this is a call for us to be very careful when we wander close to spiritual danger. Because this is an unfortunate fact about the church, is we tend to be so fixated on our morality and our standards of right and wrong that we tend to think it's a virtue to get angry with people who are sinning. We think it's a virtue to be hostile to people who are not doing what we think. We think it's a virtue to hate them. And instead, what God calls us to do is something very, very different. It's to share the grace and the love of the gospel and not to look for scapegoats out there, not to look for someone to blame your problems on. Well, what happens is this woman comes out, and it turns out, it says she's dressed like a prostitute, but she's not a prostitute. Verse 13, she took hold of him and kissed him, and with a brazen face she said, "I have fellowship offerings at home. Today I fulfilled my vows, so I came out to meet you. I've looked for you and have found you. I've covered my bed with colored linens from Egypt. I've perfumed my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamons. Come, let's drink deep of love till morning. My husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He's took his purse filled with money. He is not going to be home till the full moon." So this is not a prostitute, it's an adulteress. And this clown should know right now, you know, that she's only in it for herself. She doesn't care about him. He's just a willing tool for her to satisfy her own desires. And he's just allows himself to be persuaded by these very crude, very crass appeals. And the thing is, again, we can have a great old time at this clown's expense and all those other sinners out there that we have contempt for, but what we should really look at is, wait a minute, look how easily we're persuaded to get all upset with people. Look how little it takes for us to become resentful, to become dissatisfied, and to become very hateful, to become very, very prejudiced and closed-minded about the people out there who we think are awful people, when really, they're just like us. They're just lost souls like us who need the forgiveness of God. Because the world has all kind of inducements to persuade you to join its nasty little arguments and controversies and debates that just inflame passions and don't really help anybody, because they want you to worship the same things they worship. They're very happy when believers in Christ become just one more angry voice out there. When we just raise our voices and yell and say, it just shouldn't be that way, and that guy's not a Christian, and that guy's evil, and he's doing all kind of horrible things, that does not please God. It's not what God is interested in. The world is very happy with that. They're very happy for people to see, yeah, Christians are just, they're just one more little faction. They're just one more bunch of angry, dissatisfied people. Nothing special over there. Nothing to see. Move along. You know, we got celebrities for you to worship. We got our superficial news programs for you to watch. We got our advertisers who want to sell you their products. We got our sporting events that we want you to get all upset and all agitated about. We got all these things. That's the same kind of crude, crass, but very effective persuasion that the world uses on us. And it's something that certainly is not limited to our time and place. We have our consumeristic society where it takes certain forms, but it's an old feature of society. There's a collection of letters written back in the 1700s in Britain called the Letters of Junius, which was written anonymously because the authorities looked for this guy for years to try to lock him in jail because he said a lot of subversive things about the British government and their way of doing things and their infringement on people's rights and such. And this guy Junius says there is a very misguided holy zeal in politics as well as in religion, because we try to persuade others as a means of persuading ourselves. And here again, there's a false respect that a lot of Christians accord to someone who gets up and says, you need to be doing this, we need to be believing this. If you don't believe the way our church says, you are a sinner and you're lost. When people do that, they're trying to convince themselves. That's why some people become so aggressive and so cruel to people who disagree with them. It's not a sign of strength. It's not a sign that they have a deep belief. It's a sign that they don't have a very deep belief and they've got to persuade themselves. You know, the art of persuasion is certainly very effective with Christians. The poet Lord Byron said that through the centuries, many Christians have burnt each other with the firm persuasion that the holy apostles themselves would have done exactly the same in their situation. Because we get so self-righteous. We get so self-righteous about our little doctrines and our little methods that we just can't get that perspective that God is wanting. And so we fall into the snare. We fall into the snare as this man does. And Another great passage here. It says he follows her like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into a noose, like a bird darting into a snare. Except that usually animals are a little smarter than that. You know, most of the time animals don't fall for something quite so obvious. You know, you have to do something to trick an animal usually. You have to deliberately deceive them and be cruel about something or make it unfair and use a weapon that they don't have. You know, people always say, oh, this great, oh, he shot a rhinoceros. Oh, what a brave hunter. Yeah, well, give the rhinoceros a gun and then see how brave he is. You know, people always talk about the right to bear arms. Well, do they believe in the right to arm bears? You know, that's a way of looking at it. He's comparing this goofy person to a willing animal, an animal who would willingly get itself slaughtered. You know, I remember an old Far Side cartoon where there's this line of cows going, and the big sign says Al's Slaughterhouse, and there's one of the cows is trying to cut in, and another cow says, "Hey, no cuts, we were here first." You know, just it's kind of, you know, they're just in a big hurry to get into that slaughterhouse. But see, here's the thing again, as my old pal Adrian Monk says, sometimes we're in such a hurry to get to that spiritual slaughterhouse because we carry around these ugly attitudes in our hearts and think it's spiritual to judge. We think it's spiritual to criticize and condemn. And instead of carrying around the things that are going to keep you safe spiritually, which is a gracious attitude, a loving attitude, a willingness to accept other people for what they are. No matter how disgusting they look to you, no matter how worthless they look to you, realize that every soul is precious to God. He really means it when he says that. If you carry that attitude around in your heart, you're going to be kept spiritually safe. Now, you know what the world's going to do to you? Well, what did they do to Jesus? But see, that's where the perspective comes in. You've got to know what God is promising you. God is not promising us not to have trouble in this world. In fact, Paul wrote to Timothy, everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus is going to get persecuted. But the alternative is, as Ephesians 4 says, to get blown and tossed by every wind of scheming of deceitful and crafty men. But unfortunately, that's the way a lot of Christians live too. We got to keep up with these current affairs, these issues, these controversies. We got to tell them what God thinks about it. We got to raise our voices and make sure they hear the scriptural point of view on that. We've got to get involved in all these things. We got to be angry just like them so they listen to us. And that is not at all what God is after. God is after people who are willing to keep this perspective of grace and love in their hearts and be willing, if necessary, to suffer for it. Probably not physically, but certainly from time to time, to pass up opportunities in the world, to have people look at you as if you're strange. Now, maybe it's easy for me. I talk to squirrels. I'm pretty strange to begin with, so maybe it's not a problem for me to do that. Some of you are not at all strange by the world's standards, but we still should all be willing to live in a way that is really going to be at odds with the world's wisdom. Trivia question today. The great movie director Alfred Hitchcock. This is Linda's favorite movie director, by the way. You would not expect that. Little known facts right there. Linda loves Hitchcock's movies and his television show. Well, what was Alfred Hitchcock's profession before he started making motion pictures? Was he an engineer? Was he a dentist? Was he a florist? Was he a grade school teacher? Or was he a chef? Well, the thing about Alfred Hitchcock that is so noteworthy about his movies, if you watch his movies, he's called the master of suspense. And his movies are known for being real, real frightening and scary. But if you actually watch them, there's very little violence in them. There's very little gore, next to no gore. Very little even violence. There's just a lot of tension, a lot of building up of fear and anxiety, and a lot of just human nature, the way that human beings are trying to manipulate each other and use each other. And at some points in his movies, it just becomes unbearable, the situation that he's set up. And he's very deliberately does that. He's very skilled at it. And if you read things that he wrote and that people who work with him wrote, he was extremely attentive to detail, and he had a very keen insight into human nature. And he traced his interest in suspense and anxiety and fear back to when he was a little kid, something that his father did to discipline him. When he was 5 years old, he disobeyed his father. And his father was one of these old-fashioned guys, you know, discipline, law and order. And his father punished him. He had a friend who was a policeman, and he had his friend, the policeman, arrest 5-year-old Alfred and lock him in a jail cell and say, this is what we do to boys who disobey their parents. And just leave him there. And he was only actually there for about 10 minutes, but Hitchcock wrote that the rest of his life he had nightmares about it. It was horrible because he was just in this cell. And he said, this is what happens when you're bad. And so the rest of his life, he just had all these anxieties about arbitrary punishments and things like that. That is the wrong kind of discipline for those of you who have youngsters at home. That is not spiritual discipline. Hitchcock used to be so afraid of the police, in fact, Hitchcock never learned to drive. Because he was so afraid of the police, he wanted to guarantee that he'd never get a driving ticket or a parking ticket. So he never learned to drive. He would not drive a car. He would not take the chance that a policeman would even stop him. And this is what kind of put that in his head. And so Hitchcock, all his life, had a keen insight into human nature. What makes us afraid? What makes us do things? What makes us believe things? One of Hitchcock's sayings was, he used to say that every church should be required by law to have a sign out front that says, "Very important if true." In other words, Hitchcock knew that a lot of people who think they're very religious, they're just doing it, but they're not willing to question it. They're not willing to really examine their beliefs, which is one of the things that Proverbs is telling us about. Well, Hitchcock had a very keen attention to detail. He would work very closely with the writers. He would draw diagrams and pictures of all the things he wanted to happen in his movies and have it all laid out in advance because he knew how little things can really affect your thinking, your emotions, and get you drawn into something like that. And that's what made his movies so effective. Hitchcock was not someone like Rod Serling who liked to tackle controversial events head on. He kind of looked a little bit more basic. He just would bring out things about human nature itself. Why we believe things, why we're afraid of things. His very first job, his first motion picture he worked on, his first job was, this was back when they made the old silent movies. He became involved in the 1920s, and those old silent movies, you know, they would act out something on the screen. You'd have someone up there, and then there'd be a little sign there that would say, "Pay the mortgage by Friday or I'll seize your home." And then there'll be a, "Please, sir, save me and my family," would come up on the screen. Well, that was Hitchcock's first job, was designing those little what they call title cards. He was very skilled drawer. He was a very skilled draftsman. His lettering was perfect. That because he was working as an engineer. That was his training. Before he became into motion pictures, he went to what was called the London County College of Engineering, and he was an engineer. So there you go. And Hitchcock later, little spiritual parallel, learned the things that he learned as an engineer, he learned to apply them to his true career of motion pictures. The attention to detail, the willingness to think through something and make it work exactly right. That's why Hitchcock's pictures were so known. He could make you terrified of something without any violence or anything like that. So, if Phil or Lloyd or anybody, if you're looking for a second career, you can put those to good work with people. And Hitchcock was never, he never had any pretenses about doing something great. People, one time a reporter asked him, "What do you view as your purpose in life with all these movies that you're making?" He said, "My purpose in life is to scare as many people as possible as badly as possible." That's because he knew that that's what a lot of people wanted, and it made him a lot of money. And so he just kind of used it as a way of saying, "I'm going to teach you a little bit about human nature, since that's what you like." Well, to close out, a little illustration. Hitchcock also had a television show for a good many years, a little short stories that would illustrate some aspect of human nature. And there's one show that I always remembered because it was not scary, it was just kind of funny, is about these two friends who worked in this office shuffling papers around and dealing with accounts and real tedious stuff all day long. If you remember E.G. Marshall and Jack Klugman, two really good character actors from back in the 50s and 60s. And they were these two office workers, and the one of them gets a letter in the mail one day. And it says, Dear Joe, I'm contacting you because I think you're the kind of person that will benefit from my advice. I'm able to see into the future, but for philosophical reasons, I can't directly profit from it, but I want to help someone like you because I think you deserve it. And just to show you that I can predict the future, in next Tuesday's mayor election, the mayor is going to be reelected. And so the mayor gets reelected. Oh, that's interesting. So then he gets another letter the day after that. It says, "Dear Joe, I hope you can see now that I can predict the future, and I really want to help you. And so I'm going to predict that in the championship fight this weekend, the champion is going to lose his title." And so this guy says, maybe this guy's right. So he goes off, bets $5. Sure enough, it's an upset in the fight, and he wins his bet. And then the guy writes the next week, Dear Joe, I think you understand now that I really can help you. And so he starts predicting three or four more things, and they all happen. And then, of course, he gets a letter. Dear Joe, I hope you appreciate all the help that you've gotten, and because he's made lots of money on these bets. So I hope you understand, you know, just for reasons that'd be hard to explain, I'm not allowed to directly profit from this, but, you know, I'm kind of a poor man. I could really use if you wouldn't mind sharing some of your wealth with me. So they go, oh, sure, no problem. Writes him a check for a couple hundred dollars. So a couple more predictions work, and then the guy writes, Dear Joe, I hope you've appreciated all the help I've given you. I actually know this stock tip, this little-known stock that's going to go way up. And the thing is, Joe, I'm really having some trouble here. I really need a lot of help. I need the money to pay for, you know, my mother's operation and so on and so forth. I really could use a few thousand dollars here. So Joe writes him a check. He sends a stock tip. He says, buy this little-known stock called Athabasca Mines. Well, this guy embezzles money from the office. He takes thousands of dollars out of the accounts at the office and puts it all in this stock. Well, this stock goes up. So this guy puts the money back, retires, he's out of there. Well, all along his friend, the other guy, has been saying, oh, you're gullible. You're going to get roped in. You're going to get caught up in this. Don't do this. It's just a fake. It's some kind of scam. Well, the guy makes millions of dollars off his stock. He goes off and retires to some Caribbean island. So this other friend is thinking, did I miss out here or something? So he wants to track down this guy. All he's got is a post office box address. And there's these letters that his friend had. And so he goes to the post office and says, I really want to track down this guy. And he sees the post office box 725. Okay, well, here, fill out this form with how much money you lost and what you're planning on suing for. I don't think you're ever going to get your money back, but at least maybe if we ever find this guy, we'll put him in jail. Wait. We're talking about something different here. I'm talking about this guy that can predict the future, and my friend made millions of dollars and all this. He says, oh, no, this guy, what he did is he sent out hundreds of letters to people. Half of them said the mayor was going to win re-election, and half of them said he was going to lose. And then he sent another letter to the ones when the mayor won. He sent letters to those people claiming to have predicted it, and he sent half of them a letter said the champion was going to win the fight, and half of them a letter the champion was going to lose the fight. And then so then he still had a few dozen people left that both predictions were right. So then he kept narrowing it down every time. And there was this one guy that all the predictions came true, and the fool sent him like $5,000 or something like that, and he sent him some stock tip. See, it was all a big scam. Someone got lucky, but a lot of people lost out. That's worldly wisdom. We chase the world's wisdom because it's so easy for us to get sucked in by our self-interest. And this one guy made it. And that's what the world holds up to you. The few people at the top who became rich by exploiting other people, or many times just by getting dumb lucky. A lot of very wealthy, famous people are not even that smart, and some of them aren't even that bad guys. It's just they got pure dumb luck on their side. And that's the worldly way of looking at things, is you want to be one of those people. You want to find something magical prophet. Oh, goody, magical method. We do that in the church. We look for someone as a magic method. Oh, that church over in Podunkville did this method, and all of a sudden they had 5,000 new members. Oh, how exciting. Well, maybe they did it after they got the method. It's probably just luck. It probably has nothing to do with some silly method. Because if it's something that relies on a human method or a human teaching, it's not from God. Godly wisdom is getting a godly perspective. What we have to offer is not something the world's going to value. Peter said to the blind man, silver or gold I do not have, but what I have I give you. We've got grace, acceptance, tolerance, sensitivity that the world can't even grasp, much less give to anybody. That's what we have to offer. That's the spiritual treasure behind the spiritual wisdom. Thank you for your patience. God let you go. We'll see you next time. We'll be in chapter 8 next time.